Across the road from King's Cross Station in Sydney, there's an unassuming but very important medical facility where all sorts of people come to inject drugs with the supervision of a compassionate and non-judgmental healthcare team. The Uniting Medically Supervised Injecting Centre has been operating since 2001. They report supervising over 1.28 million injections since then. They've managed over 11,000 overdoses without a single fatality. Dr. Marianne Jauncey is the medical director of the Supervised Injecting Centre. Dr. Marianne Jauncey, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, you're from an Australian family, but you were born in New York.
Yes.
How did that happen?
In upstate New York. So my dad is an astronomer. He was working with Cornell University. Classic story of they went for a few years and kind of stayed for 10 and put down roots and had kids. And then at some point made the decision, I think, in part about gun laws and in part about, you know, the types of kids that they wanted to have, and just made the decision we want our kids to grow up Australian, and so came back when I was 4 and my brothers were 7.
And where'd you move to?
Initially very briefly to Sydney, but then pretty soon settled down in Canberra. So I spent my childhood years in the nation's capital.
I've heard mixed reports about growing up as a young person in Canberra, particularly during that time. What was it like for you?
We like to defend the nation's capital. I was very fond of growing up there.
Out of loyalty or science?
Shall I plead the fifth? Look, I mean, I suppose as an adult now, going back, and my parents still live there, it's a beautiful place. It's, you know, it really is a bush capital. I can, you know, if I go for a jog, I'm seeing kangaroos within, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of where my folks live. It's quiet, it's safe, it's pleasant. So I continue to defend it and I'm very fond of it.
What did you do to hang out in Canberra?
Well, not a lot. I suppose that's the point, isn't it? So I left when I was 18. I took a year off before I went to uni and I went travelling. So admittedly, as soon as I got the option to leave, I did.
Noted.
And haven't lived there since.
So you took a year off to travel. Were you going to definitely be studying medicine when you came back?
I was, because I'd been accepted, but it was never, to be honest, a burning passion. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I imagined that I was going to do science. My dad's a scientist and I love the idea of sort of working out the why of things and how things work. And someone suggested that I get into medicine because I'd done well, I suppose, and that there was this newfangled course at Newcastle Uni. And I applied one medicine at that university and then everything else was science, and knew that I was taking a year off. And to be honest, if they hadn't given me the permission to defer for a year, I actually think I would have declined the offer and taken up science. So I'm grateful that I got to travel that year and still get accepted into medicine.
What did you do in that year?
Went travelling back to the United States, country of my birth, just to kind of have a year off, live a little, learn a little. And I, you know, I think I did in some ways quite a lot of growing up, just learning that I could survive on my own and I could make decisions, and yeah, it was a great year.
When you graduated from medicine, did you have a sense of what your career was going to look like, and how close is that to what you've actually done?
I totally and utterly had no idea. I was the kid that got to the end and just went, ah, what do I do now? Like when everybody else is throwing their graduation hats up in the air and going, oh, we're finally finished. I'm like, what next? Because I, again, each year I finished, I kind of said, okay, I'm through to the next year of medicine. Can't think of anything else I want to do, so I'll just keep going until something kind of appears, and nothing ever appeared. So I then spent a few years really just sort of trying to see if something fitted, you know, working here. I went and worked in New Zealand for a little while, tried out a whole bunch of different kind of aspects of medicine, and really totally genuinely had no idea. And it wasn't really until I started working in King's Cross that I thought, oh, I think I've found my people.
Before we get to King's Cross, though, you did have a time working in Zambia. How did that come about and what was it like?
So during the course of studying medicine, we had the capacity to do 2 electives, and I chose to do 1 in Northeast Arnhem Land and 1 in Zambia. And it was extraordinarily eye-opening as a, you know, a young idealistic medical student who'd, you know, lived a pretty sheltered middle-class life, to be working in a place where most of our patients had either HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, or all 3, where we made the diagnosis of AIDS purely on the basis of pretty much a handshake, holding someone's elbow, feeling a very large golf ball sized epitrochlear node and going, okay, you know, so there wasn't blood tests, there wasn't, you know, the capacity to do any kind of significant investigations. And, you know, we had no opiate pain relief. You know, I remember seeing one fellow that had crushed half of his lower leg under a very heavy instrument who was on fourth hourly Panadol for pain relief. So it was totally mind-bogglingly different world experience for me. And in a funny way, the hard bit was coming back, because what was supposed to be familiar to me, suddenly I was seeing it through different eyes. And I remember on the plane on the way home, somebody complaining about the food because they'd ordered vegetarian, they'd gotten an omelette, but, you know, they didn't want eggs because they didn't see eggs as vegetarian. And this sort of stoush broke out. And I remember just thinking, you've got food and you're complaining. And just, so it was the coming home that in many ways, unexpectedly, I found harder than being there, because I would, you know, I came home even to like the place where I was living and just looked at all of the stuff I had and thought, none of this is necessary. You know, like I saw people when they would, you know, I remember seeing this one fellow from a village, because we do a lot of outreach work, and a fellow came up, spoke to one of us and just started walking off. And I said, oh, you know, where's he going? And he said, oh, he's going to visit family. They, you know, live about 4 days that way. I said, well, how's he going to get there? And they said, he's going to walk. I said, but he's not carrying anything. Like literally, he just walked off, didn't even have the equivalent of a handbag, and was just going to rely on the kindness of a combination of strangers and families and just set off. So to come back and see the sheer luxury of everything that we had, all of which we take for granted and none of which we actually really show any true gratitude for, that to me was actually what I found really, in a funny way, more distressing than being there.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Dr. Marianne Jauncey, who's the medical director of the Supervised Injecting Centre in Sydney's King's Cross. Marianne, you also mentioned Arnhem Land. What was it like being a medical student up there?
Equally eye-opening, in that some of the statements that would be made at university about certain, you know, by lecturers trying to teach us things, and they'd say, oh, something about, you know, rheumatic fever and the criteria, and oh, you'll never see that in Australia. And I didn't have the wherewithal or the confidence to say anything at the time, but literally thinking I saw two cases of it last week because I just got back. And again, this notion of you don't see that in white Australia and you don't see that in the cities of Australia, but in regional, rural, remote and Aboriginal Australia, we see it all the time. And again, this mismatch between, you know, what we think we know and what we have that, and we don't appreciate. So again, I suppose in hindsight, that was probably some of the planting of the seeds in my mind about public health. Not that I think I didn't totally fully grasp that those seeds were being planted at the time. But I think that was when I started understanding that actually good medicine needs to change systems. It's not just about one-on-one treatment and care of an individual. If you actually really want to improve the health of a population, you got to really change the systems, because it's those systems that are holding people down.
This segment's called The Year That Made Me, so it's about a time. But I think in your case, it's as much about a place as a time. What year have you chosen, Marianne, and why?
I chose 1998, and that was the year that I first started working in King's Cross as a eager, keen, young, totally naive doctor at a place called the Kirkton Road Centre. And I suppose for me, even though I was totally green, didn't even have the language to speak to the clients that were attending, didn't understand their world or their life. I don't have a history of injecting. I hadn't done work in drug and alcohol or harm reduction. Really, somehow, very, very quickly, I had this sort of deep sense inside myself that I'd found my people.
So where had you been working previously, and why did you move to the Kirkton Centre in King's Cross?
So I'd done various bits and bobs in largely in hospitals, a little bit, you know, around Australia, a little bit in New Zealand. And a friend had actually ripped out an ad and flicked it to me in a when we still used the post, in an envelope, and it just said, "This sounds like you!" exclamation mark. And I turned it over, and it just said, "Flexible and eclectic approach needed to work with vulnerable populations."
I'll take that, yeah.
And I went, "Yeah, oh yeah, okay." And so I applied for the job, got an interview. Turning up for the interview was this whole kind of process where they had very naturally assumed that as a female coming into the front desk and saying, "I've never been here before, I've got an appointment with a doctor," they assumed that I was a prospective client, and a very reasonable assumption was that I was somebody that was working in the sex industry. And so they got me to start filling out some paperwork. And after sort of a few minutes, it was clear that our conversation was at cross purposes. And when I said, "I'm here to see somebody about a job interview," and, you know, we made the connection that, okay, I didn't need to fill in that paperwork. They just looked at me and smiled and said, "Oh, okay, we don't need you to do that. In fact, we can just take you straight upstairs." And even again, I'm not sure I realised it at the time, but, you know, of course, what would you have said, Julian, in that moment?
Probably the worst faux pas imaginable.
Totally. That's what we all would have said. We would have gone, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." Because in our mind, mistaking somebody for somebody who works in the sex industry is offensive. Well, why on earth is that offensive? And so they, again, this first seeds to me of actually what it is to be non-judgmental. It's not just to be nice. It's not just to be kind. It's to actually treat people as an equal.
So clearly your friend had a sense that this job might be the right one for you. When you got the job, did you immediately have a sense, yeah, these are my people?
Look, it probably took me probably maybe days to weeks, but I think there was this sense of these are really good people who do really good medicine, they do really good work, and they're here because of a value proposition about the way they view the world. And I suppose over the ensuing however many decades, that's really stayed with me, that I think in health we tend to think that what should guide our judgment is, you know, what the published medical evidence tells us is effective. And that's got to be part of it. But that's actually not the way you make a decision if something is right. You know, it is actually part of our role, not only as doctors, but as humans, to work out what's actually the right thing to do. And we're talking about values then. We're not talking about peer-reviewed medical literature to tell us whether something is the right thing to do. And, you know, I've clearly had an awful lot of learning and my, you know, I used to say that my learning curve felt like it was vertical. I'm not sure it's necessarily even that far off still. But I think a lot of what I've learned is about the importance of values in healthcare and how we don't really talk about them because it's a little bit uncomfortable and we don't really think of that as being part of our role. And I totally think it is.
Mm. When did you move to the medically supervised injecting centre?
So I filled in 2005, which was a baptism of fire when Ingrid van Beek, who was the founding medical director, went on some well-deserved long service leave, which was when we lost the premier, lost the leader of the opposition, had a new leader of the opposition whose first policy announcement was, "If I'm elected, I'll close the medically supervised injecting centre," and A Current Affair did an expose accusing our staff of being drug dealers. I just remember thinking, "Ah!" And literally pretty much for 9 months, I just came in every day with a tick going, "It doesn't close on my watch. It doesn't close on my watch." It was just, literally that was my job. The service could not close on my watch. When Ingrid came back, it had to still be there.
Yeah, pretty basic KPI.
And anyway, did stay open. But then it was a few years after that that she retired that I actually then got the job permanently in 2008.
What was it like moving to that facility? What did you learn from observing the way that setup was already operating?
So a lot of the clients were very, very familiar to me. The staff were familiar to me. You know, I'd worked there before, so I knew kind of how it worked in the three stages and the walking through. I suppose when I'd done some of my early shifts, when it first opened, when I was still employed at the Kirkton Road Centre, I think the thing that strikes you as a healthcare worker who's been working with people who inject drugs for many, many years is that we provide clean injecting equipment knowingly to people who inject drugs. We do that fully funded by government. I'd ask your listeners, come up with a number. How many needles do we give out fully funded by government every year in Australia? it's a big number. Think of a number, add a zero, double it, you still won't come even close. Mm. And so we give these needles, but by definition, our laws then demand that we send someone away to use that equipment out of our sight. When we know that the medical evidence shows us if somebody is present and is able to recognize an overdose and respond, they won't die, Julian. And so how is it that we allow our healthcare workers to give out clean injecting equipment and then demand that somebody goes into the shadows? So for me, those first few shifts working and seeing people inject shouldn't have been shocking, because I'd given out thousands of syringes and seen thousands of individuals and put hundreds on treatment for heroin dependence and whatever. But I had never been present when somebody had injected. And how can I provide the best advice if I don't really know what they do? So I remember seeing somebody who was licking the tip of the needle, was in a state of withdrawal, was getting quite agitated, wasn't able to find a vein, you know, and the only people I'd ever seen were, you know, trained healthcare workers with uncapped syringes. And so, you know, there was this kind of cognitive dissonance in terms of what this person was doing with the needle. But how do I know to tell someone not to lick the tip of their syringe if I've never been present and didn't know that that was something that people did? So it provides this incredible additional opportunity, not only for some simple health promotion messages, but just to hold space for someone and to create a little bit of an opportunity, because, you know, the fact that it took a church is not lost on me. Like, it took a church who is okay about talking about values, who understands that values is the core part of what we do. This is what calls us into service. And, you know, their tagline of welcoming people exactly as they are. Health services don't do that. We're asking you what's going on, waiting for you to finish talking so that we can tell you what we think you need to do. Mm. And suddenly you've got this service who is all about the person, who is all about welcoming them exactly as they are and creating space and, you know, bearing witness, for want of a better term. And it suddenly creates possibility in a way that I'd never seen before, because people were actually okay to be themselves. They didn't need to pretend that they were going to go into treatment. They didn't need to pretend that, yep, I'm giving up tomorrow, doc. Yep, I'm interested in treatment. They just were free to be. And that creates the space for possibility that is shut down in other areas of our healthcare system.
Marianne Jauncey, who are some of the patients from your time as a doctor that really stay in your head or your heart?
So I remember a woman that I've spoken a little bit about before. So I've called her Abby, but I met her very early in my days at the Kirkton Road Centre when I was still terribly green. And one of the counsellors had called me in to see her to do a bit of an assessment whether or not she was safe to go to an emergency accommodation. And I remember seeing this young woman who had pulled out most of her hair, who probably didn't weigh more than about 35 kilos, who sat there, you know, having not slept or eaten for days, and just very bluntly and honestly said, look, my mum was a junkie whore. She died on the streets of King's Cross. I clearly know that's what's going to happen to me. Fucking hell, you know, why do you bother? I know I'd be better off dead. And the thing that I'm eternally ashamed of is, just for a second, I wondered whether she might be right. And I suppose the reason that she stayed with me is partly to remember my shame of thinking for a second, oh my goodness, would she be better off dead? Because I was so green and so overwhelmed at the complexity and challenge of her existence. And I suppose the beauty of what I learned at the Kirkton Road Centre and watching them work with her over the subsequent months and indeed years was that it's so simple. And again, you know, it's what the church would say is life is precious. It's just that simple. Life is precious, and where there's life, there's hope. And did she have an awful lot of trials and tribulations ahead of her? Totally. And in fact, the last time I saw her, she was doing well.
I was going to ask you, what did become of Abby?
So the last time I saw her, she was waiting quietly in our waiting room at the Kirkton Road Centre. She'd been put on treatment for her heroin dependence. Her hair had grown back And I walked past and she just looked up at me, smiled and looked back down, and she was reading a book, and I turned my head and she held it up to me, and it was Catcher in the Rye. And I just walked into, you know, into my clinic room and just had a moment and thought, that's the person that for a second I wondered if she'd be better off dead.
That headline of no fatalities at the supervised injecting centre seems to be like the sort of the simple vindication of the centre's harm reduction philosophy and the approach to medical care. During your time on the job, how close has it got to that first fatality?
Not very close at all, if I'm honest with you. So the reality of heroin or opiates, all opiates, whether it's heroin, whether it's morphine, oxycontin, fentanyl, nitazines, they act on your brain and turn off a little bit, a receptor that is what reminds you to breathe. And so the mechanism of death and injury is through lack of breathing or hypoxia. So if you recognize that and you see somebody's breathing slow or stop, you intervene and you either give them oxygen if they've still got some breathing, or you breathe for them if they're not breathing at all. Without wanting to minimize the skill of our staff, it's quite an easy, obvious thing to do. This is airway management and external airway resuscitation where it is needed. And so we are good at that because that is our core business. We do that regularly every week. And so it's actually obvious that people aren't going to die from what would otherwise be a simple, uncomplicated opiate overdose. Now, our clients are gradually getting older and our clients are gradually getting sicker and longer lists of, you know, what we call comorbidities. So, you know, our clients do still die ahead of their time, but they should never die of an uncomplicated opiate overdose if they are supervised and people know how to respond. Now, pleasingly, now in Australia, we have much greater access in the general population to a drug called naloxone, which is a totally safe, easy to use heroin antidote or opiate antidote, which you can get as a nasal spray. And so community members can do that supervision and reversal of an overdose. Thank heavens. But you know, it's just when you talk to a mum or a dad who's lost a kid, I find that still very poignant, because the reality is if somebody had been present with their child at the point of overdose and knew how to respond, their kid would be still there and able to come home for Sunday dinner.
So why is it that the model of the injecting centre hasn't spread more widely? Perhaps you can just recap for us to what extent it has spread and why you think it hasn't spread more widely.
So when we opened in 2001, we were the first service not only in Australia, but in fact in the English-speaking world. So it was a big deal. A quarter of a century has gone past where the evidence has been totally unequivocally clear about these being not only life-saving but life-changing services that also are of benefit to the local community, because they take the public injecting and the public overdose and the discarded needles off the street and into a healthcare centre. But the reality is drugs is still an emotive topic and drugs is still a political topic. And I wouldn't even be here talking to you if people didn't find the notion of drugs interesting. It's kind of a double-edged sword. Everybody has a view, sex, drugs and rock and roll. Everybody has a view. But it's incredibly polarizing. And I suppose what I love about Uniting as an organization is that they, having run this service for 25 years and learned a lot about the politics and about our clients and about how you could actually do some systems level change, is that they've really leaned into this space and now are actively advocating not only to increase our investment in the treatment of dependence and addiction, but to change the laws about how we respond to drugs and people who use them, because it is the stigma and the discrimination which is holding the system in place.
You talked about what sounded like a very stressful first few weeks in the role of medical director, filling in. You had to basically make sure the place didn't close, which is fair enough. What have been the toughest times for you since then in the role as medical director?
I think sometimes the politics, although I understand it, I find incredibly frustrating. So when there's either been headlines that have been totally false accusing me and my staff of promoting harm and wanting to see the destruction of not only King's Cross but, you know, the demise of the individuals we see. It's just frankly offensive. So sometimes the politics and the media is just, oh, you just think, you just want to shake someone. Equally, when we've had clients that we've known very well over many, many years, that we hear them having passed away. Obviously, no one's ever passed away in our service. But, you know, sometimes we know someone better than anyone, because even if they are linked in and do have a doctor or another clinic, they might go and see someone there every few months for a follow-up visit or a case manager. We might see them every single day. We might see them more than once a day. We know them better than anyone else in their life. And we're terribly fond of so many of the people we see. And so there have definitely been some times over the years where, you know, someone's passed away and you just, you know, you just wonder, you know, a sliding doors moment, if something else could have happened earlier in their life, or just the, you know, if onlys.
Mm. Are there many people who use the centre today who were using it when you started working there?
There's some. So the way we register people, it's a confidential service and we don't keep real names or full names on file, and we give people a code. So we started with A001 and we're up to U. So, you know, nearly 19,000 individuals that have used the service, even though in any typical year we only see maybe 1,200, 1,300 people. But, you know, we talk about the A numbers, and yeah, there are still some people that we see that have got A and B and C numbers. Now, have we been seeing them consistently for 25 years? No, never. The nature of addiction is as a chronic relapsing condition is that people have space and time that they can do very well. They might be in treatment. They might have gone bush and gotten off using. They might have periods of time in custody. But the nature of relapsing, that word relapse means it is an inherent part of the condition that they go back to using. And so we've seen some people that have had really long periods of time of doing really, really well, that something's happened in their life, it's all gone pear-shaped, and what they've learnt as a coping mechanism has been that drugs have helped me get through something, and so they might have a period of time coming back to use. And I suppose the trick for us is that's not a failure. You know, I don't know what people's future holds, and if they want to get off drugs, I will support them in any way I can to get there. But actually, for me, all I want is one, that they're still alive, to come back if need be, and two, that if they want a space for any positive change, that that's what we try and create.
What have you learned, Marianne Jauncey, from the clients of the Injecting Centre over the years?
Kind of everything. Like, since I began working in King's Cross in the late 1980s, it is the people who have used the services and the people who use drugs that have literally taught me everything and really been incredibly generous with their time and their stories, that have shared things with me that they didn't have to share, that have taught me about what works, what doesn't, the importance of not just being kind, but treating people as an equal.
What's an example?
So, for example, in the first few years when I was working at MSIC, I felt that it was my job to advocate for the service, and often media would say, oh, you know, can we talk to a client? And I was terribly protective and quite sort of paternalistic in a way of saying, nope, nope, you know, it's not fair on them, and, you know, you can't necessarily get informed consent from someone, and, you know, you're going to find someone, that's up to you. My job is not to, you know, give you access to our clients, because I need to protect them. And of course, there can be instances of somebody being acutely unwell where that might be appropriate, but the people that use our service are whole and complete human beings with their own autonomy and their own capacity to make decisions for themselves, where certainly if somebody's acutely drug affected, it wouldn't be, you know, the place to get informed consent. But they are totally able to give informed consent and make decisions for themselves. And I was being totally paternalistic about thinking that I knew what was best for them. So that's been something in more recent years that we've really shifted on. And if that's something that is helpful for them and they want to do, sure, I'm going to make sure that we try and support them in any way that is appropriate and they would benefit from. But it's, I'm not the gatekeeper. You know, that's not my job. And I think I've learnt more and more that, you know, yes, I'm the director and often I'm the, you know, the person doing the interviews, but it's their stories that actually are the most interesting and it's their leadership and their kind of gift to the sector that it's my job to try and support and raise up.
Sounds like it's a pretty stressful job at times, whether it's on the medical side or just dealing with the media and things like that. What do you do outside work to keep an even keel?
Sometimes not enough. I think I've definitely had moments where my work-life balance has been less than ideal. I've got two beautiful kids and so hopefully sometimes they will just, you know, Mum, it's time for Friday night fun.
That doesn't
night.
Necessarily sound like stress relief.
You know, we might just go and watch a silly movie or, you know, go out for a meal. In the last 6 months, I've taken up jogging, which if anybody knew me from my early days would go, that's just not possible. Who are you and what have you done with Marianne Jaunty? So I think I've more recently definitely realised the benefits of just getting a bit fit in terms of keeping an even keel. But otherwise it's doing something totally different, you know, knitting a jumper, doing some gardening, something totally outside, you know, what King's Cross is in terms of a sense and a feel and a vibe, totally relaxing and silly and crafty or whatever.
You've been the medical director for
forever,
almost 20 years now.
Yeah, just call me Methuselah. I like saying at that point.
Yeah, well, have you ever thought about leaving?
I have. I have to admit, I'm not quite sure what else I would do. I sort of feel like I know this. We've got a wonderful new operations manager who's just started and she's worked in brain injury for even longer than I've been the medical director and she's made a total shift. And I was looking at her the other day. She's only been here, you know, a week or two. And she said, I wanted a change. And I was very admiring of that level of courage because it takes courage to jump out and do something totally different. There's a few things that I feel like need to happen before I'm going to be prepared to leave. So we turned 25 this year and there really isn't anybody sensible left in the country that doesn't acknowledge this is a life-saving service that's made a difference to the people who use it and to the local community of King's Cross. And yet the law that allows us to operate has a clause in it and says that says you'll be the only one. So, you know, I say to people, you know, we've got keys to the city and we've published papers and we've won awards. And if we did exactly the same thing in the same way with the same people and the same resources in a different building, we'd all be at risk of arrest. How does that make sense? How does that make sense? So what we're asking is that not that we open up another centre on this street corner or in this suburb, but just allow the system the capacity to apply for the privilege of a license to open up a service somewhere else. It's going to look different. You know, 25 years has passed. You don't necessarily need the model that we've got in King's Cross when things have shifted, where we need to be agile and responsive to the needs of communities now, which is different to what King's Cross was back in, you know, 1999. But it's just crazy that, again, if you think about that number that I asked you about, how many syringes do we give out in Australia every year? The answer is 55 million.
Wow.
And we have two buildings, one in Sydney where I work and one in Melbourne, that people are allowed to use them. How does that make sense? You know, as the mum of a woman that I met when I gave evidence at the coronial inquest into the death of her son, as she said at that inquest and I said, we're only doing half the job. We give them the syringes and then we tell them to go away. That's not right. It's not fair. And it's not inevitable. And it has to change. It really has to change. So I've kind of mentally set myself my own KPIs and that would be one of them.
Right. Yeah. What are the others?
There was we wanted to get a fantastic consumer group going, which we've now had for about 15 years. And I want to make sure that they are part of our recruitment process. So we want to have them on our panel when we're recruiting for new staff and we haven't quite got there yet. So I want that to be in place before I go. And I want to make sure that we have a dedicated Aboriginal person that works in the service. So about a third of the clients that we see, new registrations and frequently attending clients, identify as Indigenous. That's an undercount. If you look at our prison system, at least that many identify as Indigenous. And, you know, that's not because Indigenous people are more likely to use drugs, Julian. Like, that's hopefully pretty obvious to people. It's that the prerequisites in terms of often early childhood trauma and intergenerational cycles of abuse and neglect are more common. And, you know, there's a reason that people end up taking a substance that makes them feel like they can cope with their life on that day and then end up running into trouble with it. And so I, you know, we've been trying for a long time to get funding for an Indigenous worker at MSIC, and that has to happen before I leave as well.
Marianne Jaunsey, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you for the year that made me. Thank you so much for coming in, and
my
all
pleasure.
The best for ticking off those
my
ambitions
KPIs.
For the centre.
My
yes.
KPIs.
And we always finish with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
Oh, good Lord. So I really wanted to come up with a cool song, and I enlisted all of these people to try
I'm
and help
I'm pretty happy
me because,
with your selection, just quietly.
Okay, because like I just don't think that I have a very cool kind of, you know, musical taste. Anyway, they just said, Marianne, be honest. And I said, well, the honest truth is, you know, Take On Me, Aha, because
fantastic.
Of course, Morton Harkett was, you know, going to be my husband when I was 14. I was sure of it. So I'm sure at this point I'm losing all the street cred that I might have got. Anyway, it's Take On Me.
Have you ever seen them live?
I have. I locked eyes with Morton Harkett at the age of 40. It was the first ever concert that I went to. I, you know, had my life mapped out. Anyway, it didn't turn out, but I'm okay.
Marianne, thanks again.
Pleasure. Thank you.